Health All Warriors, what is up? Higher Learning is on. It is I, Van Lathan Jr.
And it's me, Rachel Lynn Lindsay.
Back. Rachel, how are you feeling?
I feel much better. Now, for those of you who don't know, I had the flu. Probably still do. I'm still at home. I had two strands of the flu, A and B. Didn't even know that you could give two at the same time. And despite us putting out an announcement on Twitter, people were very upset that they didn't know we didn't have a podcast. I apologize, guys. I should, you know, we'll do better making an announcement. But as you can tell, this voice is a million times better than what it was on Monday. Van, you heard it.
Yeah, she
couldn't
talk.
You immediately were like, no.
You get,
no.
Rachel, you get. I'm worried about you.
No,
you get sick a lot.
I have been sick since January.
Like you, you get sick a lot. Like are you eating enough apples and shit? You eat apples?
Man,
what?
Not really, but
you have a very fragile voice.
I do have a fragile voice. My voice does get hoarse.
Yeah.
But I didn't know I had the flu. And as I told y'all on the last podcast, I was going to be hosting a Cowboys watch party. Good thing you didn't come, Van, because I had a house full of people. And I was yelling at the TV. People stayed for hours after. We were having a good old time. I was drinking. And I think that's what just took me
to
another
place. High gear.
Kicked it all the way into high gear. Gave me the original and the remix version of this, of the flu.
I think you're sick because of the football you had to watch.
I'm sure that didn't help. Thanks, Van, for making me relive last weekend.
What's going to go on? What's going to happen in Texas, man? What's going to happen with the Longhorns? What's going to happen with the Cowboys? I'm not even trying to be a troll. I'm just asking because I know some of my Texas fans are very unhappy.
It's not like we didn't play a really good team. You know, it's not like we lost to somebody who's not ranked. We knew it was going to be a challenge going into that game.
You're always talking about this ranked shit. You lost to TCU at home when you were favorited. Like, they should have won that game.
But we should have won the game.
Yeah.
But it's not like it wasn't a possibility that we wouldn't win. Right. I don't know. I'm out of excuses. Right. I don't know what to say. What year is this for Sark? Is this two or three?
It's only two.
I can't even remember.
And they improved from last year. Yeah, they improved from last year.
You don't have that much time in Texas. Like, they expect 10 season wins. They coach three and out.
Right.
Charlie Strong, three and out.
Yeah, but that was different.
Who was after him? Who was after him from Ohio State? I can't even think of Herman.
Tom Herman, yeah.
Herman. Herman, he was two. I don't even think he was 3 years. He was two and out.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's like, you got to produce at Texas. We don't have patience. And especially with the new quarterback coming in next year, which will be interesting to see because Quentin's really good. Which will be interesting
to
see.
He's not really good. He's playing okay. Quinn Ewers. So you guys have a lot of quarterbacks down there that everybody thought. So you have Arch Manning coming in. I can't wait for Arch Manning to play so you guys can realize what's happened.
Well, they want a new coach with Arch. I don't know.
Why would they get a new coach with Arch?
I'm just telling you, Texas doesn't have the patience. We shall see. Want Sark to stay another year. Mm. Whatever, we lost. Cowboys lost. Definitely shouldn't have lost that game. That was an embarrassment. Only thing I can say is we were cold. We didn't have Zeke, but not that that matters because Pollard's better anyway. I don't know. Van Der Esch went down for a quick second. I don't know. We're not hot.
I did the unthinkable to come do this podcast today. So I started playing a game of Madden, and I do something in Madden. Whenever I see like Lamar Jackson, like I get scared they have him. So I like go overboard. You know what I mean? Like I'm like, got to spy the QB and do all of this stuff. And this guy's just dropping dimes. He was up 21 in the first quarter with Lamar Jackson with me. 21. Then he went up 35-7. Well,
okay.
I scored in the second half. I scored in the second quarter. Then I got the ball back in the first on the first possession of the second half. And I scored. Kicked it to him. He went for it on fourth down. I stopped him. Got it back. I scored. And I had come all the way back, and it was time to do the podcast. And I had to concede the game to get on here. I was about to pull one of the greatest comebacks in Madden history. I had his number. I had figured all his shit out. I was going to come back and win that game, and I had to cut the shit off to come and do the podcast.
Very Wait, exciting. Were you playing against yourself?
I was playing online.
Oh, because you were like, I thought you said you had Lamar Jackson.
No, then
you were
like, they had going Lamar Jackson. Him. This guy okay, had Lamar I was Jackson. Like, so he had Lamar Jackson. Yourself? And I was.
Okay.
Disgusting. This guy had Lamar Jackson and.
It's a hot toddy.
And you're drinking a hot toddy? No, I'm saying that because you said playing with yourself. Like you're just,
okay. You're weird. Let's grow up.
Let's grow up. Whoa, you're talking weird stuff. Shout out to Diallo Riddle. Brilliant, brilliant man. Southside Show, Sherman's Showcase. Diallo Riddle, amazing writer. Shout out to Diallo Ambashir. Diallo was going to be on the podcast on Monday, but Rachel got sick.
I'm sorry, Diallo.
So we have to reschedule Diallo. Diallo will be coming up, I think, was it on the first or 28th. Something like that? 28th or something
it's
like
the
that?
First. Nice.
It's the first.
So Rachel doesn't even know. Like, look, it's funny. It's funny when people think that, like, people don't understand, like, the dynamics of the podcast. People don't. If people
what
only
are you
knew,
about to say?
No, I'm not going
to
say.
What are you about
it.
To
if
say?
People only knew. If people
You've
only
already
knew.
Started. Oh, I'm the problem. Let's just say like this. It's 50-50. At times, I am the problem.
Donnie.
Oh, it's just been a while. It's just been a while Donnie. For you. At times, lately, it's been me. I've scheduled a flight, messed up the time. It's been me lately.
Rachel did
sick.
Rachel,
heaven forbid.
Rachel did the podcast one day from a cave in Afghanistan. She's on the side. Like you can hear people making airport announcements in the background.
Some of us make bigger sacrifices. Some of us just put pause on a game. Mm-hmm. Some of us
I didn't put pause on
actually
a game. I quit.
Find a hole in the middle of the airport. It's a podcast for the Thought Warriors.
I love this, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, damn. Because at first, I'm like, because here's the thing with me. I never quit a game.
Okay.
So my friend, my cousin Ra-Ra, shout out to Ra-Ra. One day me and Ra-Ra were playing Madden and I just couldn't stop him. I couldn't stop him. So it got to the point, you know, he's talking all of his shit. He's doing his thing. Mm-hmm. It got to the point to where I was playing out of spite. But also... Mm-hmm. I was downloading information. I remember I lost that game, some crazy big number, but then I came back and beat him 3 times in a row. So I never quit. I take my lumps. I have a good Madden record, so I never quit. I take my lumps. But in this game, it was different. I had figured this son of a bitch out. He was taking advantage of the fact that I was scared of Lamar Jackson and I was over blitzing, playing too much man coverage. So he was just like, taking advantage of coverage busts and throwing over the top of my head. Then I made him start quarterbacking a little bit and I started getting in his ace. Oh, yeah. But I cut that off to come do the podcast, man.
I feel like you needed to say that so you feel better about leaving the game.
I was only down 1 score.
I know. And you wanted people to know that. So you
and
feel
if
like
I, if
you
I know. Stop him, if I stop him again, baby, we. And he was going to be so. I was going to make this nigga quit the fucking game forever. So some chubby black bastard came back on me when I was up. Oh, I couldn't
can
score.
Can he see you?
No, he can't see me. But he can feel that okay. I'm fat. I feel like now. I feel like now people just know. You know? Either
no,
like people say stuff on the podcast. They're like, Van, breathing so hard he sounds nasally. That's because it's like blubber in my nose passages. You know, in my throat. I'm like my throat is fat. So you can feel it. They can feel it on the other side. I know that they can feel it. Anyway. Did Brian get sick? How's Brian doing? I saw him in a suit on Instagram.
Brian's fine. We've really been living separate lives this entire month of November.
Really?
He had COVID.
Interesting.
He had COVID. And then I now have the flu. So right. He's good.
You think he gave you the flu? You think he...
I am holding on to that. I do say I think somehow whatever his COVID, it fell onto me as the flu.
Down mutated.
It mutated. Yeah. I do.
Yeah. So when you guys are apart because of sickness like this, what happens? Like, what goes on in a relationship? Do you order Postmates or something?
We're big Postmates orders, period.
What does he order but from like Postmates? Because he got abs.
No. He actually does meals. He uses this company called Factor. And he does.
Oh, Jesus Christ. All right, let's move on.
His own meals. Or he does Butcher Box. But we've been separated. I've been eating a lot of chicken noodle soup. Mm-hmm.
Sold on the side.
But it was sold on the side. No, with promethazine on the side.
Whoa.
That's what they gave me. I'm sick. I'm really sick.
Rachel, Rachel, hold on for a second. Wait, Rachel, you got some promethazine over there?
I do.
Hold on. How much promethazine you got?
Hit me up.
How much promethazine? Wait a minute, man. How much promethazine?
Even the pharmacist looked annoyed when he had to give me the promethazine. He was like, do you have the flu? Yeah. And I was like, yeah, fool. They called it in for me. I got two strains of it. He was like, okay, this is what you need to do. Yeah. When I looked at the bottle, because she didn't tell me. She just goes, oh, I'm going to give you a cough, something for your cough. Uh-huh. And I looked and I was like, you gave me promethazine.
I'm going to come over there. I said, look, I'm going to go to the store. I'm going to grab some Jolly Ranchers. And I used to use Fanta
with
Strawberry.
The Sprite.
I used to do Fanta Strawberry with the Jolly Ranchers.
With the Jolly Ranchers for sure.
You can't fuck with my mix. I just had the Fanta Strawberry.
Maybe not. I never did
Jolly Ranchers in there with their, put it in there, shake that son of a bitch up, and we good, baby. God damn, them was the days. Well, like in parts of Louisiana, they look at you crazy if you go there and you try to get some promethazine. They don't want to give it to you.
And he looked at me crazy.
Yeah.
The pharmacist was like,
Rachel and their double cup.
Like, they called it in. I didn't even walk in with the written. They called it in for me. That's what, hot toddy.
You got promethazine in there right now?
No.
Rachel, you on lean? Oh,
I'm
my
kidding,
God.
I don't.
Rachel drinking lean. Donnie, jump on.
I don't.
This about to be a good podcast.
Donnie.
It's not in here.
Donnie. I feel like we have to have an intervention for Rachel right now, man.
It's not in here.
Rachel. Rachel. Yo, thought warriors.
It's mailbag time.
It's mailbag time. All right. Y'all don't even get the reference out there. Real Texas shit right now. Scary shit happened in the world, and we're going to talk about it next, the big deal of the day.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
Yeah, I thought it was over, Rachel.
What was over?
It, us, what? Stuff, people, stuff. Yesterday, trying to take a chill day, was on a walk. I was trying to look at my phone a little bit less, and I saw a headline that said, two dead in Poland from what seemed to be a Russian missile strike.
Mm-hmm.
This was the entire danger of the war. There was a thought that in this sort of protracted war between the Ukraine and Russia, that people should be worried about one day just this huge, huge offensive against the Ukrainians, that this was going to, there's going to be some kind of exchange of nuclear weapons in there. The West would have to jump in. The much more likely scenario would be that even by accident, a NATO country, which obviously the Ukraine borders Poland, would suffer some sort of attack or some sort of casualty. And then all of a sudden, Article 5 comes into play. All for one, one for all. The United States is defending NATO as if NATO is New Mexico or Texas, and now all hell broke loose. So the moment that this was reported, Poland said that a missile had hit Poland, a Russian missile had hit Poland, I was like,
right,
I need to know everything about this that I can. The Pentagon came out and they were like, look, we don't know what's going on right now. We don't have any clue of what's going on. But just to let everyone in the entire world know, we will defend every single inch, of NATO territory. Now we know Poland and NATO have said that the missile strike wasn't a Russian attack. Did this have you shooketh? Were you scared? Two people died in this attack, and we should make sure that their lives are properly remembered, because even though we're not in the midst of World War III right now, two people are still gone forever. And that is the cost of this war, this illegal war of aggression that's been waged against Ukraine for the last 8 or 9 months. Were you afraid when you saw that this happened, Rachel? I know people on Twitter were going nuts.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I guess, the escalation anxiety that we feared could happen with a war like this. Russia seems to be very unpredictable. And I don't want to say that, I don't want to at all, you know, I guess, tone down what's going on. I mean, this war has been going on for months at this point. But I would say that the media, at least here, hasn't been reporting on it in the same way that it has before. So I would think that it's human nature that people have moved on and not thought about it in the same way they were when it initially happened. So then it's on our mind, but I wouldn't say at the forefront, like when it initially happened, when it was like, why is Russia attacking Ukraine? So then when this happens, it brings it back to the forefront. And this is what, when this was reported, it's like, well, this is what we feared, that Russia was going to start their attacks on neighboring countries, on allies of Ukraine. And we know that Poland has very well been that. A lot of how the West has communicated and brought things through to the Ukraine has been through Poland. Poland has taken in a lot of refugees from Ukraine. And this place where this missile attack happened, well, where this missile landed and sadly killed two individuals, was 4 miles from that Ukraine-Poland border. So this is people's fears becoming a reality. So absolutely, I was terrified, because it was like, is this the beginning? Where will this end? To answer that part of your question.
Interesting is that, for me, it didn't even have to be an intentional Russian attack. What happens if it's an accident? You know, and then you really, the way that works is the United States and other NATO member countries, obviously Article 5 is, it's the part of the NATO agreement that says, hey, if one country goes to war, we all go to war. All of us, one of us, one of us is all of us. Okay. So that means that whatever Poland wants to do at that particular point, we have to fall in line. Right. And help out. And that's like, that's what an alliance is. It's not like we can be right. Like, no, they have too many nuclear weapons. If that's the case, then NATO and other alliances that we have like NATO, it would be, there'd be total non-confidence, a loss of confidence, should I say, in the U.S.'s ability to maintain friendships and help out and, you know, come to the aid of its allies. And you can't have that. You have to show strength. So I was really, really anxious about what's going to go on in this situation. Because even if it's an accident, you still have dead Polish citizens. And the countries have to decide how they want to rectify that or remedy that. Yeah. For his side of it, Zelensky, obviously the president of Ukraine, who's become quite the celebrity and the consequential world leader as Ukraine continues to battle and fight just honorably and viciously against Russian aggression. He doesn't believe that the missile was Ukrainian. Says he has no doubt that his country was not to blame for the missile strike. Now, I will say this. I'm sure that he believes that. He seems like a very honorable man. But I also, obviously, believe that he wants as much help and support in his in Ukraine's war with Russia as he can get. And obviously, if people were to believe that the Russians were responsible for the missile attack, then the entire world, the entire free world, i.e. NATO, comes to the direct aid of Ukraine. So I'm not saying that he's lying, but I am saying that he wants people to know just how dangerous Russian aggression is and how far they've gone. And, you know, shame on us for having forgotten what's going on over there.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. That's it. I mean, like, shame on us for having forgotten what's going on over there. But you guys, we're living in incredibly precarious times where you have a major world power with an Armageddon toolbox over there in Moscow. Mm-hmm. That's just, we're ever so slightly on the brink. Anything could go wrong. It's not something that we're going to think about all the time, but when you have a country like that, that is threatening the world order. And I know that's a scary term for people, because people think, oh, advance a new world order. But the world order is, a part of it at least is, you know, you don't attack a country, a sovereign nation, without having first been attacked. Now, I know that the United States broke that in Iraq. But, you know, geopolitically, this is all incredibly precarious. This is scary, scary stuff. And I think this is the first time that a lot of people felt, in a long time, should I say, that a lot of people felt that Jesus Christ, this could blow up and we could get to a point to where nations have to make real dire decisions. But I felt that.
Saeculum. makes you think about that for a second. But I think it's also important, whether this was intentional from Russia or accidental from Ukraine, I think it's important to note how this is going to make the Polish government and people feel. They lost two citizens. And the Polish people have, this might have been, might possibly, and I'm sure, you know, from what I was reading, there seems to be a lot of exhaustion on the side of Poland, because so much, they've taken on so much in regards to this war. I mean, they've let refugees come. The country has provided financial aid, and it's taken a hit on their economy as well. So this, the fact that they lost two of their citizens could even potentially weaken the commitment that they've made to Ukraine, which is so important what's happening in Poland too, that because, as I said earlier, the West has gone through Poland to provide effort to Ukraine. So I think that it's also, we have to pay attention to how this is affecting that country, because they were, whether it was intentionally or accidentally, affected by this missile and what's happened. And then becomes the fear of, okay, well, as them being a part of NATO, as allies, does more protection need to be provided to their borders? Because it's being reported that this was a Ukrainian missile that was combating a Russian missile, because they're shooting 80 to 100 missiles sometimes a day. So what needs to be done on NATO's part to protect Polish people so they feel more protected, as they're giving so much to Ukraine? What's being done for them? So I think that's something important to pay attention to Poland, but also other neighboring countries as well.
All right. You guys, hug each other. World's a dangerous, scary place. All right.
Okay, a lot of you hit us up because we didn't have a podcast this week due to, you know, my flu sickness. And we've obviously been paying attention to it as well. But we have to talk about Shanquilla Robinson, the tragic, horrific death of Shanquilla. If you don't know, on October 28th, to celebrate one of their birthdays, Shanquilla Robinson and six of her friends flew to San Jose del Cabo, or Cabo San Lucas, in Mexico, for a long weekend to celebrate this friend's birthday. Within 24 hours of Shanquilla and her friends touching down, it was reported that Shanquilla had passed away. The initial reports of Shanquilla's death were that she was found unconscious in her living room, and it was due to alcohol poisoning. Her friends frantically called her mother. The authorities were also involved and also attributed it to alcohol poisoning. But as the medical examiner got involved, her death certificate stated that Robinson had died from a, quote, severe spinal cord injury and atlas luxation. And that is the loosening or detachment of her first vertebrae from the base of the skull. Absolutely disgusting. Now, her parents, her mother, who received the call, the frantic call from her friends, felt that it was very suspicious under the circumstances that her daughter had passed away. She's the one who stayed on the Mexican authorities, the medical examiner, eventually got that death certificate that completely contradicted the original findings, or what was reported to her as to the reason that her daughter had passed away. Subsequent to that, a video came out of Shanquilla completely naked, fighting one of her friends while her other friends were recording this video. She was defenseless. The woman was beating her up, threw her down to the ground. Her friends are saying, Shanquilla, why don't you fight back? Not intervening, not stopping it, just recording it like they're watching a sporting event. And that's where the video ends. So there's a lot of outrage, rightfully so, surrounding this murder of Shanquilla, because that's what it obviously is at this point. It's not alcohol poisoning. Her face was allegedly swollen as well, in addition to the spinal cord being severed and her vertebrae being broken from the base of her skull. A lot of outrage has also been at the fact that media outlets, national outlets, are not covering this. And I don't want to compare one death to another, but a lot of people are saying when Gabby Patino was missing, every outlet was covering it. All hands were on deck. But with Shanquilla, there doesn't seem to be the same effort to discover the not even just the reason, but who was responsible for the death of this young woman. I believe she was 25 years old, had a promising future ahead of her, was there with her alleged friends to celebrate. And within 24 hours of touching down, she lost her life. Van, your thoughts when you heard this?
So I have a couple of thoughts. Number one, we're not comparing one death to another. I understand right. that you were being sensitive by saying that. We're asking the media, where in the fuck are you? Mm-hmm. Gabby Patino is one thing. My heart goes out to the family of Gabby Patino. My heart goes out to the family of any of the many women that over the course of the years, which is disgusting in and of itself, that have been abroad and found themselves lost, killed, or otherwise assaulted, and it becomes front page news everywhere. All right. Now, Shanquilla's gone. Awareness and sounding the media alarm helps put pressure on Mexican authorities and, quite frankly, authorities in the U.S. that might be curious about this to get to the bottom of what happened. So when people are asking why there isn't as much conversation or demanding more conversation about it, they're not doing it from an emotional place. There's a concrete reason why people want to hear the story talked about. Because the more people understand it, the more people hear about it, the harder it is to ignore. And then right. if you can't ignore it, perhaps we get some answers as to what happened sooner rather than later, which might help the family get some sort of closure. So we're not comparing deaths. We're asking, where is everyone? And that's a fair question right. to ask. I don't know what to believe, I like, or not what to believe, or what to make of this. this story has led me to do a little research. I think everyone has done some research. We've all talked about femicide and how that's on the rise in Mexico. Sobering stats. More than 10 women are killed every single day in Mexico. And tens of thousands are missing. The rate of femicide, which is killing women specifically because they are women, because of their gender, is on the rise in Mexico. It's been on the rise for years and years and years. 70% of women over 15 have said that they've been the victims of some sort of violence. So this is a big deal. So you look at that and you say, well, there is an epidemic of this in Mexico, and Shaquilla could have been the victim of how dangerous it is to be a woman in Mexico. That could have happened. But at the same time, the situation with her friends, the violence that they were taking part in, the fact that they left and came back, from what I understand, right? Like, the friends left and came back without her.
Mm-hmm.
This is weird. I'm not looking to finger anybody for any particular crime that they might have committed or might not have committed, but obviously, seeing that she was involved in a violent encounter naked with everyone else, like taping it,
watching recording. Yeah.
right before she passed away, is just insanely sad, enraging, and really, really suspicious and peculiar. So I'm just wondering what the fuck happened to Shaquilla. Like, what happened to her?
Well, even on social media, and this is allegedly, but from what I've seen on social media, some of the people, the friends, alleged friends that were involved, are speaking out, and only saying they'll speak out to the highest bidder in regards to an interview. It seems to be very reckless and just disrespectful in the way that they're handling the death of their alleged friend. But it also highlights this issue of not caring about Black women. You should have read this story, watched a social media video, read a headline, and been horrified by what happened to Shaquilla, and honestly thought that this could happen. You know, you've been told you should be careful about who you travel with. But this, you never know what people are plotting against you. You never know who's for you and who's not.
We don't want to be too hasty by putting Rachel's very... We want to make sure that we're responsible.
I'm saying alleged.
Yeah.
But I think it brings on the bigger conversation of, when you're traveling, especially specifically out of the country with friends, you have to be careful. Allegedly, fine. But what I'm saying is, I guess the bigger picture, to not be so specific, if you want to be careful in regards to that, and I understand that, is that there is a Black woman who's dead. There's a Black woman who's dead under very suspicious circumstances. There's a Black woman who allegedly died from alcohol poisoning, but her death certificate, and now that her family has the body weeks later, it totally contradicts what they were originally told. So there's a Black woman who is dead, and things are not adding up. And people need to be outraged to the point where they're at least trying to understand and figure out what's happened to give justice to Shaquilla, if so, such a thing even exists, and give peace of mind to that family who lost their child or sister, daughter, niece, friend, and they aren't, from a national media perspective, they're not as concerned. So if nothing else, that's something that needs to be called out.
Interesting shenanigans from the State Department here as well. When the news first broke, Queen City News reported that the U.S. State Department, this is according to Yahoo, said that there was no clear evidence to suggest that she was murdered. Rolling Stone then followed up with the State Department, who didn't comment on whether or not her death involved foul play, but referred Rolling Stone to Mexican authorities. Mm. That's peculiar to me.
Sounds like they're punting.
Well, that's, in my opinion, a definite punt.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you want more information, the investigative agency closest to it is going to have that information. But whatever information that the Mexican authorities have, the State Department should have it now. They should be sharing. This is the death of an American citizen, a suspicious death on vacation in a friendly neighboring country. There's no information that the Mexican authorities should have that the State Department shouldn't have at this point. That tells me that they're not being quite vigilant enough with what it is that they're trying to accomplish, which is tell the American public what happened to this black lady. So, right.
Video is damning enough.
The video is
damning enough for you to do more.
The video is damning enough because it injects violence into the situation. We don't have any more information into this except what we just gave you guys, but we hope that we have a better understanding of this as it moves forward. And I just can't imagine anyone trying to get a come up off the death of their friend. I haven't seen that. You've seen it. I haven't seen it. I'm not saying it is, but if it is happening, God damn, man. God damn, bruh. Fuck. We got Malcolm Jamal Warner coming up next. Let's take a moment. Just real quick. It's a very troubling story. Heart goes out to the family of the young woman. Everyone who has to move on in their lives without her right now. It's a very troubling story. Let's take a moment real quick. Take a breath. We got Malcolm Jamal Warner talking about a lot of things on the other side of this. He's got a brand new album. It's out now. It's nominated for a Grammy. He's already won a Grammy. We're going to talk to him about that, how he's maintained his longevity in his career, how he did not fall victim to the curse of the child star. And also, obviously, a little bit about his time on The Cosby Show and what The Cosby Show means to people now and maybe what it should mean to people now. Malcolm Jamal Warner on the other side of this break. Fantastic interview. Stick around. It was a longer one. The brother gave us a lot of time. We'll get to that in a second. You guys.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
A treat! A treat on the podcast today. I've never met this brother before, but he feels like my brother. I'm not even going to lie.
Right?
I've been following his life since I was a kid. Like, seriously, watching him. He put on the Gordon Gartrell. I'll never forget it. this guy's a piece of television history that we have on the show right now. Actor, producer, director, musician, poet. Malcolm Jamal Warner joins us today on Higher Learning. First question I'll ask you. First of all, thank you for joining us, brother. When you hear people talk about you like that, like a piece of television history, like you can't tell the history of television without showing your face.
Yeah, sure.
That's good. What is that like for you?
Yeah. It's dope. I mean, I'll start there. But I think it's also it's a way of life. You know, it's almost like it is what it is because I was, you know, from 14 on, you know, I've been a part of this, you know, iconic cultural phenomenon, if you will, right? So with that, you know, that's been a great blessing. There are, I think for me, there's also a certain, you know, responsibility that comes with like holding that space. You know, my whole thing has always been, ever since, you know, coming off of Cosby, has always been, you know, making sure, like, you know, I was like, I can't go from that show to go doing bullshit, right?
So, sure. Yeah.
So there's a certain responsibility that, you know, for me, I've had to take on in terms of, you know, I'm very specific. I'm very clear that I have no interest in doing roles that perpetuate negative stereotypes of our people.
Right. Word.
Which means I don't work as much as, you know, I think I should. You know, I think I've been, you know, I've been able to maintain a wonderful career post-Cosby. But, you know, a lot of that has come with being, you know, meticulous about and being very mindful about the kind of roles I do. And as a result, between, you know, gigs I go out for and don't get, uh-huh, and gigs I turn down because I'm not trying to, you know, perpetuate certain images of us, I go through periods of unemployment, you know, a little longer than I'd like.
Yeah. You know what's funny about that? I remember one time I saw Malcolm in something and I was like, oh my God. So way before Jamie Foxx, way before what's your man from Moonlight, Trevante Rhodes, Michael Jai White played Mike Tyson. For an HBO original movie, which, you guys, is a really good movie.
Yeah.
Michael Jai White played Mike Tyson. What, it must have been like 96, 97?
Yeah, about 95.
95.
Yeah.
So he played Mike Tyson. And in the movie, Malcolm played one of Mike's friends from back in the day, and they was kind of on their hood shit a little bit. And I remember watching the movie and be like, oh my God, Theo has changed. Do you remember that role, bro?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember, you know, I love being able to do that role because it was something, you know, it was so different for Cosby. And this was, you know, this was pre-Malcolm and Eddie. So I'm like really coming off of the whole Theo thing. So to have the opportunity to do that type of thing that was so different, like I needed that, not just for my own acting work as in terms of my own craft, but I also needed that as part of my body of work to show that there is more to what I do than just Theo. You know, and because that role was based on, you know, Rory, you know, Mike's best friend, you know, in the context of, you know, playing somebody, you know, real.
So when Van intro'd you on here, he said you're like family, which is so true. We've had this discussion on this podcast. I've never related more to a family on television than I did the Cosbys. Like that was my family.
Yeah.
So for you, and you talk about this responsibility, how would you say that that show redefined, or maybe just defined, public perception of the Black family in America?
Yeah, I mean, it did. Obviously, it did that. The best way to say it, you know, the thing that made that show all that it was, right? All of the things, all of the stereotypical things that you didn't necessarily see on that show, was because Mr. Cosby was creating this show, and he and NBC always kind of were had a difference of perspective, because while NBC thought, okay, well, we're doing a show about this upper middle class Black family, Mr. Cosby was like, no, this show is about an upper middle class family that happens to be Black. Right. So when you think about it, it's really the first, you know, Black sitcom on television where the humor was not predicated upon being Black, right? The humor was predicated mm-hmm. upon like a human experience. So I think that's, you know, that's one of the key things and why that show was different. Whereas now, even, you know, post Cosby, we may have, you know, Black shows on TV, Black roles where they've upped the social economic class, right? But the execution is still kind of stereotypical executions. They just have professions. So I think that's one of the reasons why how it reshaped how people, you know, saw Black people, because, you know, this family was very clearly Black. You could tell by the dress, by the art, by the music. But it was a show everyone could relate to because it was about the human family condition as opposed to the Black family tradition. Hmm. And that turned some people off. There were Black people who were like, sure. Well, Black people don't really live like that. You know, that's not real. But the fact that there has always been a Black middle class, mm-hmm. right? Throughout yeah. history, there's been a Black middle class. Or if you just go, you know, as recent as, you know, Cliff and Claire's generation, right? You know, so many of their generation were the first in their family to ever go to college.
Yeah.
So their parents were going to make sure they were doctors, they were lawyers. So, you know, this life that, you know, people wanted to say didn't exist was really because they weren't exposed to the reality that these people do exist. Mm. So long answer to.
No, that's a great answer. I'm going to.
No, yes.
I'm going to come back to, because I want to talk about, you're nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Supporting Actor. You won a Grammy with my man, Robert Glasper.
Yeah.
And Layla Hathaway, you with all of my friends, and we don't even know each other. So you're doing some great work, and your new album you have coming out, Hiding in Plain Sight. We was nominated for another Grammy.
Yeah.
This year, congratulations, man. Like, you do all a man of many talents. I want to ask you about something.
Yeah.
Recently, Aaron Carter passed away. And the first thing that I thought when Aaron Carter passed away was how he had been a child star. Mm. He had been a child star, and obviously we know that there is a long list of child stars that for whatever reasons could not adjust into either life after the sitcom ended or adult life period.
Yeah.
And we've seen that really with a lot of your contemporaries, you know what I mean? People that were on TV at the same time as you were, and then people after, and to be honest with you, people just before as well, you know?
Yeah.
Why didn't that happen to any of the Cosby kids? It seemed like everyone turned out to be, you know, really well-adjusted, like, and brilliant people. Erica Alexander, brilliant. Yeah. You know what I mean? Raven Simone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Everybody, yourself. Yeah. Vanessa had a talk show at one time, didn't
yeah.
she? So Tippus Bledsoe, everyone together. It seems like Keisha Knight Pullum, you know, when I was in college, she changed the image a little bit and we loved it. But you know what I mean? I'm like, God damn, Rudy. But
King Magazine, huh?
King Magazine. I'm like, shit. But everybody turned out. Why? Why is that? Denise, like everybody, obviously her family now is Lisa Bonet's. She's got her own multiverse of beautiful light-skinned people. So, like, why did that happen? Why did everyone from the Cosby Show turn out? You think, is there anything that in the DNA of that show that made that possible?
There are a couple of things, man. I would start with our parents, right? Our parents were just very involved in our lives. I'll go one before that. We shot Cosby Show in New York as opposed to LA. So we were already removed from Hollywood and so many of like the Hollywood stuff. So when you grow up on television in Hollywood, your best friend is on the same lot as yours, you know, the next stage down working on their television show. So there becomes this insulated way of growing up in Hollywood, where you kind of, you know, you're a little bit separate from reality, but then the world you in is kind of a, you know, fuck the world in itself. You know, so it's just, so we did not have that experience. Like, our first studio was in Brooklyn, Avenue M and East 14th Street. It's a Jewish neighborhood. There was no commissary. So at lunch, we had to go out into the neighborhood and get our food, wherever we were going to decide we were going to eat. So just that, like that kind of experience, or growing up in New York where people don't care who you are.
Right.
You can get played in New York because you're on some, do you know who I am?
Yeah.
So the world with which we grew up during that time kept us in a very reality-based focus. You know, because of course, New York, you live in the dopest high-rise, you walk outside and you're faced with hardcore reality. You don't get that kind of growing up in LA, in Hollywood. But then also, like I said, our parents were very, very present and very much, you know, if you look at, you know, young people who kind of go by the wayside or whatever, you have to look at their parents first, see where are their parents, like who are the, if the parents don't serve as the guidepost for the kid, then there's so much room for them to go off path. You know, my mom told me, I was 14 when Cosby first hit. And, you know, when it first hit, the numbers were like out the box. And I'm 14 and my mom was like, yo, baby, it's great that this show is the phenomenon that it is, but this show could be over next year. What are you going to do when the show's on? She was like, I can type. I can always get a job. What are you going to do when the show's on? So, you know, for me personally, she had already impressed upon me this concept of longevity, this concept of life after Cosby. And in between that and being in New York, you know, I grew up with a very real perspective of, you know, who I am, you know, how I navigate through this business, how I navigate with a soul. You know, my dad was good for that, helping me, you know, keep my soul intact. He set some really good foundations. You can't be named after Malcolm X and Ahmaud Jamal and be about dumb shit.
Yeah. Fuck over that legacy. Yeah.
My dad set me up. I was 15 when I figured it out. And I called my dad. I was like, yo, you set me up. And he just laughed. He just laughed. He was like, okay, I get it. I got, this is what, you know, this is the legacy that I have to, you know, not just have honor, respect, and reverence to, but I also have to hold that responsibility.
In your namesake, you have your own legacy, but you've created your own legacy in your own right. I mean, as Van pointed out, you're nominated for Best Spoken Word Poetry Album for this year, Hiding in Plain View. You direct. I had no idea that you directed New Edition's Any Heartbreak video, which I love. You act. Yes, he directed. In the video, right?
I know he's in the video, but how the fuck did I not know that?
Yeah, that's why I was in it, because I directed it. But yeah.
But you were in.
So, because you don't know that, I got to tell you. So my first two big music videos was New Edition's Any Heartbreak and Special Ed's I'm a Magnificent. Big direction. My first started out directing.
I got in trouble. I think it was fourth or fifth grade because me and my man Drico, shout out to Drico, we switched shoes, right? he had one shoe on, and then I had the other shoe on.
Was it gold and black?
No, it wasn't gold and black. I had white sneakers on. He had black sneakers on. There you go. And then I was like, "Yo, give me one of your sneakers. Give me." And we was New Edition, like from the video. It's so fucking hard. Okay, go ahead. Finish. I'm sorry.
No, the video is iconic. So I was like, I know you direct, but I had no idea you were behind that video.
Yeah.
You act. You're a poet, you're a musician, as we see the guitars behind you, multiple guitars behind you right now. Of all the things that you do, what is it that you enjoy the most and why?
That's kind of like, which kid is your favorite kid? And actually, some, nice. Some parents could probably answer that.
Yeah.
They're like, I love them all because, like, it's like, I think I was probably around 30 or so where I realized, oh, you know what? I'm an artist. Like, I do all of these things. And one of the reasons I do all of these things is because I think I was about 23, a couple of years after Cosby, about a year and a half after Cosby was done. And I'm in between gigs and I'm pitching, directing stuff and whatnot. And at some point I realized, because I was acting and directing, I was like, if I keep my eggs in just these two baskets, this business is going to break my heart. Mm. So I set out to find other creative avenues of expression to keep me creatively fulfilled in between acting gigs, to keep me creatively fulfilled when the passion becomes a job and all of the things that come with the territory of having a job. No matter how much you love it, there are things that get in the way of the joy. So my thing has always been, well, I've got these different avenues of expression available to me, and let me use them because I need them. Mm. Right? Like my acting career needs my music outlet. Because where the music business is, my music career needs the acting. Mm.
Right, yeah. Right, right.
So yeah. They all feed each other, and together they all hold me up. Mm. That makes sense.
Mm. Have to ask you this. Is Bill Cosby still a hero to you?
Damn, man.
And let me tell you why I ask you. Because on this very podcast, we've talked about just having gaping holes in our childhood. And what it would mean to extract the Cosby Show. Mm. My father went to Southern University. I went to Southern University as well. But I learned what a HBCU was, not from my dad. I learned from an HBCU from the Cosby Show. Mm-hmm. Because somebody's wearing a Hillman sweater. And then I go, what is Hillman? And my mom goes, well, they probably mean Spelman. It's a school. It's like you know what I mean? She's like, it's probably a takeoff of that. But like, it's a black school. And I'm like, oh, and she's like, your dad went to a black school. Like, my mother went to LSU, my father went to Southern. But she's like, your dad went to a black school. Southern, that's the school for all. And I was like, and I just put it together in my mind. I was like, hey, every time I go up on the yard, I don't see nothing but black people. You know what I mean? So there's so much of my culture. My brain was molded partly so much due to the creations, the narratives, the stories that came out of that show. It was a major, major part of my childhood. But obviously, we all know what's happened subsequently. So for us, it's a question that as consumers, we litigate. But for you, as someone who had your entire life changed, I guess the question is Bill Cosby still a hero to you?
Right. So that that question assumes a hero perspective.
Okay.
Right? Right. So I worked with him, right? And also on my last record, it's called Selfless. His album, his record with me and Lettucey. And the song's called Brand New Day. And my very last line of that joint is, I'm holding out for an iconic love like Cliff and Claire. Mm. Right? So that's Cliff and Claire, not Mr. and Mrs. Cosby. Mm. Right. So while there was this father figure to the world, right, this was someone I worked with. This was a colleague. This was Ennis's dad. Right. Mm. It's the guy I see every day. This is the guy I see, hashing it out with the writers every single week because, they're writing something that's not what he set this show out to be. This is a man who schooled me a lot in terms of the business, but he wasn't my father, right? Like my father, I'm 52 years old. My father still kisses me on the lips.
Word.
right? So it's a very different kind of relationship that I've had with him, very different from America's relationship, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It does make sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. I'm going to switch it over to Malcolm and Eddie because I just learned something. Van, I don't know if you know this, and this could be something that just resurfaced because you know how social media is and they bring up old stuff. But with Malcolm and Eddie, and you and Eddie Griffin, I had no idea that Tupac was considered for the role of Malcolm.
What? Malcolm, this...
Okay, I'm looking at Malcolm's face. Malcolm's looking at me like... What? I had no idea.
I know not of what you speak.
So Eddie was doing an interview and it was on something. And was Eddie joking? Now I'm like, not that I know Eddie, but from what I know of Eddie as his persona, is he joking? But he literally was talking about that Tupac was up for this role and that it wouldn't have made sense for him to have Tupac in this role as Malcolm. Was this real?
I've never heard of that. Okay. I know not of which you speak. Okay.
You and Pac never talked about that? Pac,
this was real.
You and Pac never talked about that?
Yeah, we didn't rap about that. No.
Okay, since you didn't know about that, let me ask you this. Going back to piggyback on what Van was saying, I'm curious, with everything that's going on, have you stayed close to your castmates from The Cosby Show?
Me and Keisha are, that's always been my homie since she was 4 years old. She's still my homie. We both live in Atlanta. Our daughters are a couple of months apart and love each other.
Oh, wow.
Which is so surreal.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Right? It's crazy. Oh, it's so right. Crazy. It's so right. Crazy.
That's crazy.
And so Keith's the one I talk to the most. Me and Lisa are cool. You know, whenever we talk, we don't talk very often, but when we do, we're always good. And I used to talk to Tempest a little more, not so much. And then Felicia, you know, sometimes life just gets rough and I just gotta call Felicia and be like,
How do they feel about people that say take the show off the air and don't want to watch the show and all of that? How do you guys feel about that?
We don't even talk about that.
Word.
We don't even talk about that. No. No. Like our, you know, we are we're so far removed from the show.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So though we may talk about it publicly, I think Keisha and I had one conversation about, and that was because I had to call her up and big her up because I did some interview. It was like my last record. I was putting my last record in 2015. I couldn't get any interviews. I could get no coverage on my record unless I agreed to ask at least one question about Bill Cosby, right? So I did.
Wait a minute. They told you that before?
Yeah. Yeah. Like my publicist could not book me any press unless they wanted, because this was like in the height of it.
But you would say to them, you would say to them, I don't want to talk about it, or they would to you.
Yeah. Oh. My publicist, give me gigs, and you know, they're like, well, you know, we're gonna want to ask them a question about Cosby. She'd be like, no, okay, well, no, thank you. But like it was that kind of, as I'm trying to promote my record. That's, right. That's what it is. So I do this interview with AP. We do a 25-minute interview, talk about the music, talk about my acting. Like, it's a dope conversation. The last question she asks is, do you think, what's happening with the Cosby now has tarnished the legacy of the Cosby Show? And I said, well, of course it's tarnished it, because whenever we have images on television that perpetuate negative images of people of color, we always have the Cosby Show to hold that, you know, to juxtapose against that. And now that the show's taking off the air, we no longer have that. The next day, the headlines read, Malcolm Jamal Warner says, the Cosby Show legacy has been tarnished. That's the headline that ran across the line. The record that the interview that's supposed to be about my record, that's the headline. That was. So that's the thing. That's the thing. Then Keisha is on some talk show and they ask her the same question. And she's like, no, the legacy can never be tarnished. It's like there's a whole generation that went and got a higher education because of that show. We can't take that back. It's like there are people who are out who have loving Black families because of that show. So no, you can never take, you can't take that back. You cannot tarnish the legacy. So I saw that and I hit her up. I was like, yo, I'm biting that. Whenever somebody asks me, I'm using your shit. Like, that's the only time we've ever like discussed
wow.
it. Because it's yeah. not a part of our conversation.
Did you ever want to rap?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah, that's how I became a poet.
That's what I'm saying. Because like when y'all was doing, that was the goal. You were there for the explosion of hip hop. And I see that you're a poet. What would it have been like if in like 89 or 90, 91, you'd have just, I don't know, you'd have got with the Bomb Squad and just got on your Public Enemy shit and just dropped a whole wreck.
Or just you and Cockroach. You and Cockroach together.
No, my band is called Miles Long, right? So
okay.
For listeners, if you go to Spotify, Apple Music, if you type in just my name, you'll get like features and collaborations. But to hear like my catalog of music, it's Malcolm Jamal Warner's Miles Long. Miles Long was actually the name of my first rap group. So in 89, Miles Long was a rap group, me and two other cats. I was up in Russell's office with his old-ass demo tape, like, yo, the Russ is conscious. It's like, yo, you got to hear this, man.
On some De La Soul type shit?
It was not that good.
Okay.
Shout out to Russ.
Right, not that good. You know, but it was on some, you know, the DJ, you know, producer, he ended up going by Frankie Knuckles. Russell trashed the project, but he ended up fucking with my man.
Frankie Knuckles is a legend, right? You know what I'm saying? So you go into Russell's office. You got your group with you.
No, it's just you.
And you give the demo, and Russell doesn't like the music, but he ends up getting with Frankie Knuckles, who's now a legendary DJ.
He liked the music. He thought the music was cool, but he just didn't think that, you know, the rap lane was for me.
Mm.
You know, and I don't remember what his exact words were. I don't even know if he was really talking about the imaging, but he was just really like, you know, it's cool. It's a cool idea, but the skill set isn't there. I'm paraphrasing, but he was like real, like, you know, the skill set is not there.
So is that how you got into spoken word?
So I got into spoken word changed, like, move years that- later. But I've been a poet. I've been writing like my whole life. My dad went to Lincoln with Gil Scott-Heron and Brian.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My dad went to Lincoln because Langston went to Lincoln.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So my father had me steeped in poetry. Like when I was 6 or 7 years old, never took an acting class ever at that time. But at 6 or 7 years old, I told my parents I was either going to be a famous actor, a famous poet, or a famous basketball player. Like, that was my, I just knew it.
Can you hoop?
you're so honest.
I've never met anybody with this clean and honest of a spirit. Just like at least like, no, you couldn't.
Wait, what's your answer? Is it really no?
It's no. It's no. Like I look good. You know, I had like, you know, not handles, but like I had maybe a handle, right? But I couldn't shoot to save my life.
Right.
Like, and you could, you know, shoot, if you just stay on me, you could imagine the ball with it. But if you followed the ball
right
all day, no.
Well,
So,
well, you're good at so many things. I guess you can't be good at everything, Malcolm.
It's cool.
You can't be good.
But so,
you can't be good.
So the poetry has always been like a part of what I do. But the spoken word kind of came out. You know, it was before Love Jones, before poetry spots, you know, popped up all over the place. But I was in L.A. My man was telling me about this poetry spot. So we went and we see Jada Pinkett and Tashina Arnold. So they were doing poetry. And like, and all the women came up and all the poems were just were male bashing poems. Like, you just did not feel good about being a man in this room. Right? I was like, yo, this is whack, man. So me and my girl, we went home, you know, wrote something. Next week, we both came out and like, we, you know, we came in repping for, you know, for the fellas.
Right.
And just the poem that I'd written, it was so to the core that of course the dudes were like, yeah, yeah. And the women were like, yeah, you're right. So I just realized that I was writing something and it just had this universal kind of thing and people dug it. So that's what kind of pushed me into the spoken words. I was like, okay, well, rap day's over. You know, my dad has always, you know, had me in poetry. And now here is it's not just writing it and just having it, you know, reading to yourself. Here is a platform where you can actually do your poetry. You can actually, you know, perform your poetry. And then coming from stage and all of that, it just, you know, it was something what's the word I'm looking for? It inspired, I guess, all of those other avenues for me, like, you know, the writing, you know, the wanting to do hip hop, you know, the acting, the theater. It was, you know, it touched all of those places in me, you know, and this, there was a venue for this. So that's what really got me. And then, you know, then Love Jones came out and then Poetry Spot started popping up.
It became the wave. Yeah.
It became the thing.
And, yeah.
Deaf poetry and then slam poetry.
Slam poetry.
And now everybody thinks slam poetry and poetry are synonymous.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Mm. Rachel, you got something else?
Well, I want to ask you about your upcoming, what you got coming up on Fox, The Accused. I know you got The Resident, season 6, which is huge, but you also have something new. You got a lot coming out. So if you could tell us what you have coming out, The Resident, and then also Accused.
So I started The Resident. We were finishing our 6th season. and a couple weeks ago, last week, the episode I directed aired.
Wow. Okay.
Really cool. I've been
the man doesn't stop.
I worked that out for a couple of years. I harassed him for a couple of years about getting a director slot. But we're finishing our 6th year, which is great because when I first started the show, I was only supposed to do the last 3 episodes of season 1. It was just a 3 episode arc. And then here I am in our 6th season. So that's been a great ride. And Fox's in the mid-season, Fox has a new show coming out called Accused, which is a courtroom anthology. So kind of like Twilight Zone or Black Mirror.
But all in court.
Yeah. And they're all, you know, separate. They're all their own separate stories, separate episodes. I have a really crazy episode about a man who is being convicted for the murder of the man who molested his 10-year-old daughter, my 10-year-old daughter.
Jesus.
So it's, you know, it's nice light fare.
I'm about to say, there's some feel-good stuff.
Yeah, it's heavy, man. It's heavy, but it's, I think that's going to be a really important series. And I'm really excited about people seeing that episode. It's another side of, you know, a lot of people don't see.
Thank you for giving us so much time. I got one last question for you, man. You've done so much. You've like, with everything you've been a part of, you've had your own show here and now. I know.
Do you remember? Do you know that Lauryn Hill? And Steph.
Lauryn Hill, but I know Daryl Chill Mitchell. It was a lot of stuff that was going on. You know what? I always thought there was this one episode of the Cosby Show. I always thought they were going to spin Theo off, but there was this one episode of the Cosby Show where I guess Theo was teaching, or something like that. And I always thought that was a backdoor pilot. I was like, oh, they're about to give Theo his own joint or something like that. Would you have been even up for that?
So that was part of the conversation, but I didn't want it to be a spinoff. Like I wanted to actually where it was. So that's how Here and Now came
out. Yeah, because it's kind of the same type of situation, same premise.
Yeah, so Here and Now could have been the spinoff, but we tried to, you know, just kind of flip it a little bit so it wasn't just the same.
What left do you want to do? Like, you've done so much. You got Grammys, you're nominated for another Grammy, you've got music, you've got television show, you're already a television icon. You've already etched your name into the history, like I said that before. That's very, very true, right? Yeah. And it happened so early.
Yeah.
You know, like you accomplished by probably 17 or 18 more than 99.9% of actors or performers get a chance to accomplish in their whole life. What's next? What do you want to do next? Do you have any things that you're like, it would be so dope if I could do this or so dope if I could do that? Like, what's left on that list?
Well, so here's the thing. It's like Mr. Cosby used to always say, you have to remember it's a marathon. While everybody else is out running sprints, you remember it's a marathon. So when my mother was talking to me at 14 years old about longevity, my thought process has always been about what's next. Like, what's, you know, cool, this is hot right now, but what happens after this? So I've been very fortunate to be able to have a life where I've set myself up where I don't have to panic during, let's say, dry spells, right? Because if you have longevity, you have periods where you're hot, periods where you're not. So fortunately, I'm set up. So when I'm in those periods of not hot, I don't have to make desperate acting choices, right? But the road is still the road. Like once we're done with the resident and the accused airs, well, I'm back on the audition ground, right? So the whole thing about this journey is like, so many times we get caught up in, I have a hot TV show, a hot song, a hot movie, people get so caught up in that they don't think about 10, 15, 20 years from now. So like the trick really is to enjoy what's happening, but not to get caught up in it because the road is still long. You know, I got a 5-year clock.
Yeah.
So my grind,
right.
There's no end to the grind.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's I've got stuff I'm developing, like, you know, like every other actor in Hollywood does. But yeah, the grind is still, you know, it's one of the reasons why I do so much, because the grind is, if I can do several different things, they all be grinds and they all be grinds that I love, then collectively, it keeps me busy. It keeps me creatively fulfilled. It keeps me growing and honing all of those skills.
Before we let you go, I gotta ask you this. We all have our favorite. Do you have a favorite episode from The Cosby Show?
Probably the Monopoly Money. When Cliff and Theo going back and forth about, you haven't eaten. Well, I can get by and blow the cereal.
Yeah.
Or you have a car. I can ride a motorbike. Probably that one, because that was the pilot, and that's what set the tone for the show.
Man,
I didn't know if you were gonna say that or Gordon Gartrell.
If you ask me my top five, that's a different answer. But if I gotta just pick one, but Gordon Gartrell is definitely up in the top five.
So. Like calling women. I just remember somebody thinking calling women burgers. calling women burgers. But obviously, for me, the relationship that I had with my dad was most illustrated in you trying to guilt trip Cliff, and Theo trying to guilt trip Cliff, and Cliff going, "That's the stupidest thing I ever heard of."
Yeah.
Like it's like because I would watch like, you know, other sitcoms, Mr. Belvedere and all of that stuff, like, and I would see the way the white kids on the show would talk to their parents. They would guilt trip them and make them feel bad, and then like it would work, or they would get mad and like walk out the room.
Yeah.
Like, I hate you, Mom. I hate you, Dad. Like I'm struggling, and like I would try that shit, and my father would look at me like, "Crystal, we need to take this boy to the doctor. This nigga has lost his mind." You know what I mean? That just rang so true. I'm not gonna hold you, bro. You've been so gracious with your time. You are.
Yes, you have.
I'm so happy to see you well, thriving, doing your thing.
Thank you.
Grammys in your pockets. More Grammys coming to you.
Yeah. And when you get a chance, and I'm saying this to you and to, you know, your listeners and viewers too. Please, please listen to an album. It's by far my most important album. I tell people that it's an album, this record is for us. It's for Black boys. It's for Black men. It's for Black people. It's for non-Black people who have the foresight enough to see our self-healing as an invitation for them to explore their own self-healing. I have all throughout my record, Dr. Daniel Black, assistant professor of African American Studies at Clark Atlanta University.
Word up to Clark.
I will be as bold enough to say that this record is one of the most important records that you will hear come out in 2022. And I know I put a lot on it, and I invite anyone to go listen to the record and tell me I'm wrong. I'm open for that discussion.
Do we have your permission to maybe at the end of the show today play our audience out with a little bit of it in there so they can hear for themselves?
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Please. What you have an album.
Which
out,
one?
Which one do you want us to play?
Off of that record. Listen to it. Or have somebody listen to it.
Okay.
It's like, okay. Yeah, I mean, the record is an important record. That's all I can say, right?
Oh, I got you. I got you.
You know, yeah, the record starts. I mean, the record starts. Dr. Danny Black, he's on the first track. The track is called Love Song.
So we'll play that one.
And he says, the thing about a Black boy is you don't necessarily want to be the Black boy. What you want to do is you want to love him so fiercely. You want to love him so divinely that your disappointment will kill him. That's what the record starts off. So listen to the record, man, and whatever. Because there's so many chunks, and bits in there that, I'd say, you or your producers or whoever can listen to something and see what resonates the most with the show and your listeners.
Absolutely. All right, Malcolm.
That's amazing.
Thank you for giving us your time, brother.
We appreciate you
being here together. Next time you're on the show, you're going to give us some guitar lessons, man. I just got a guitar.
Bass lessons, specifically bass.
The bass.
Yeah, the bass.
Slapping the bass.
And it's me playing bass. It's me playing bass all over the record, too. So it's.
Word up.
It's all of it.
Oh, that's great.
All right. Thank you. The album is Hotter Than Plain View. Nominated for Best Spoken Word Poetry Album. I want everybody out there, all the Thought Warriors, to stream that, listen to that, go out and support that. I want y'all to make him feel our support. So we are so happy to have you. We're happy that you gave us your time. Peace to your brother. Blessings. Malcolm Jamal Warner on Higher Learning. Thank you. All right. Fantastic interview, Malcolm Jamal Warner. Look, you were hey, Rachel, that's enough.
I held it down.
That's enough.
I kept it in for that interview.
Hack. God damn it. Like, y'all, you sound like Burgess Meredith. Like,
y'all
like
see how
you
don't care about me?
Like, that's enough.
Y'all see what I go through on this podcast?
Hacky,
I sacrifice my health.
Cough.
My health for y'all.
You know what I'm saying?
My health for y'all. I'm not 100% whole.
That's enough.
But I refuse to let the thought
drink some more, Yolene. Drink some lean.
Episode,
Rachel, drink some lean.
Another episode without hearing from Van and I.
Drink some lean.
I refuse to cancel on another guest, which obviously that was a fantastic interview. And I am currently out of lean. And I will
she ain't got no more lean.
The drink up in my cup.
Drink up in,
man, hold
drink
up.
Up in my cup. Drink up in my cup. Trump. All right. So look, this is what happened. We were gone and the midterms came out. The midterms came out like they dropped, like they had a new album. The midterm elections were had.
Like
we did not. We were gone, but we have more clarity now. If we recorded Monday, the House is still up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
The House is now not up for grabs. The Republicans have gotten to 218 in the House. They're going to have a majority, albeit a smaller majority than they thought, which might sort of hinder them in getting as much of their agenda passed as they wanted to, or being on the same page. It's a lot different having a huge majority and having like a 1, 2, 3, or even 4 or 5 seat majority. It hampers some of the things that you can do, especially since there's a civil war brewing inside the Republican Party. But we do know now that we got a split government. President, dimmy-dimmy. Senate, dimmy-dimmy. Republicans have taken the House. The predicted red wave, the crushing of blue balls everywhere, did not happen. A lot of people say this is because Donald Trump. Rachel, have you been well enough to pay attention to the political happenings in the country over the last 6 or 7 days?
I have. I mean, how can you not be paying attention to it, sick or healthy? I will say that I have to come on here and say I was wrong. I was wrong. The last time we were podcasting, I said, you know what? We've lost Nevada. We don't know about Arizona. And Dems won Nevada. In regards to the Senate, let me clarify.
I know we.
Dems won.
Them
I know,
won.
I said we. Yeah. Dems won Arizona. And we know Georgia is going to a runoff December 6th. So I was wrong about that. And I'm glad that I was wrong. I also talked about the fact that nobody's pointing to the fact that it seems like the Republicans are going to win the House, which they have, and they've already started on their bullshit, right? They got their 218 seats, more than that, and they're already on their bullshit. I will say, from watching everything play out to this point, because we know who controls the Senate, and we know who controls the House. We know that Mitch McConnell was challenged for a quick second, but he's still going to hold his place in regards to his title in the Senate. Kevin McCarthy, we're not quite sure what's going to happen there as far as who's going to be Speaker of the House. And at this point, we know that Nancy Pelosi has said that she does not want a title at all. She's going to step down. And I understand that from all that she's personally been through in regards to the attack on her husband.
You
know what?
By the way, Kevin McCarthy has won the GOP nomination for Speaker of the House, so that's done.
Did that come out?
Yeah, Kevin okay. McCarthy, like he's won that. Look, a lot of people thought that the Republicans are going to get in and what they're going to start doing, impeaching Biden for walking, impeaching Biden for falling asleep, nodding off, impeaching him for all kinds of different things. It's going to be a lot harder to do without a significant majority in the House. It doesn't mean that our government is going to be functional, but hey, it hasn't been functional to this point anyway. We've been in gridlocked. We've been under the tyranny of the filibuster for so long that they can't fucking get anything done. I think the lasting lesson from the midterms was that this particular Republican Party doesn't seem to be resonating with voters like they thought that they did. And when you look back at the last 2 or 3 elections, I'm not telling you guys anything that you couldn't hear on any of the major news talk shows, but I just think it's very interesting that there seems to be real confusion as to the direction of the right. Like, it doesn't seem like America, by and large, on the whole, is going to go for fascism, extremism, and election denial. That doesn't seem like that's a winning strategy. But at the same time, there's a core base that is so dedicated and has so much allegiance for President Trump and his musings that you can't win without him. So How do you disinvite people to your party that you need to show up to have people in it? You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's really, as far as, it's one of the most, it's one of the most interesting conundrums that I've ever seen in American politics. Like, it's like the whole Republican Party is just a primary party. Great in a primary to get to the general, and people aren't trying to hear that crazy shit. The Dems, the Democrats should have been easy to beat. Easier to beat. Like, it's, things are not, well, I mean, when you look at it, I mean.
Well, no, I was going to say, I think it shows that there's a weakness in the Republican Party. There's a split in the Republican Party. I mean, as you just pointed out, election deniers, those that were backed by Trump, did not do well in the midterms. So there is this divide from those extremists with MAGA and Trump and election deniers versus more traditional, or I wouldn't say moderate, but more traditional Republicans. And I think that that's what we have as a, I guess, as a roadmap going forward into 2024. I think Trump announcing the fact that he's running for presidency is the gift and the curse to this party, right? Trump was a gift to them when he announced before. And those same things that they loved so much about him are now those same things that are hurting their party as it stands. And the fact that Trump announced, and the fact that donors, big donors, those who are leaders in the party, leaders who supported him, not even just politicians that supported him before, and family members are not standing by him, shows that there is a divide within this party. Big time. And that's what we saw in the midterms.
There's not just a divide in the party in terms of like from politician to politician. There's a divide in the Republican Party from body to soul. The Republicans were always a very simple party. They were always a very simple party to sum up. And the simplicity was their strength. It was always limited government, deregulation, family values. Somewhere in there is guns in the military. Okay. So those are the things. So all kind of in that scope. Now, when you get behind the veil of politics, they're making your oil buddies profits, and there's kickbacks and all of that stuff that everybody does. Limited government, constitution, family values, military stuff. We don't spend a lot of money. You know, we don't cheat. We don't, like, we're this, we're that. And the Democrats, the problem has always been, or the left, should I say, is that there's huge complexities in being a liberal. Like, huge complexities in being a liberal. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many different factions in the left that want to be heard. Because almost, it's almost as if sometimes it feels like being a liberal is reactive. And I think that we look at it that way sometimes.
It's more in touch with the people.
Yeah, but it's reacting to people. It's reacting to America that's already existed, and something that you know you don't want, right? And that's why it's great that we have progressive minds that think about the future and imagine a different future. Because sometimes we could just look at it and be like, well, I know I don't want to go back to 1955, or I know I don't want to go back to separate water fountains, or gays not being able to get married, or all this. I know what we don't want. So we're voting against that, right? And I think over the last 10 or 15 years, a lot of progressive ideas have come into the mainstream, and like really ways to challenge the status quo of American existence and citizenship. And I think that's great. But the Republicans always had a simpler message that was just easily digestible to people who didn't want to think about politics that much, right? It's like, now they're complicating things. They are. Elections don't work. All of these books are evil. They're giving their constituents a lot to think about. They're giving them, it has nothing to do with who they are anymore. To me, it's the deep state, QAnon, all of this stuff. They're becoming this almost mutated form of liberalism where there are all of these different factions in there and they don't have a clear, clean message for anyone.
That's it.
And they don't have a clear, they're telling you, go vote for me, but just know the election doesn't matter. And you start to think to yourself, well, what the fuck? You know what I mean? It's a weird thing to where I don't think besides the crazy people who like, when I say crazy, I fucking mean crazy. The crazy people who no longer want the version of America that we're in right now to exist, which I think it's actually probably people, I don't know if I want the same version. I wouldn't say that that's that crazy, but I think you know what I mean. I think beyond those people, just the regular voter who is a moderate centrist on either side, they just can't vote for this shit. They can't vote for it.
There's no agenda. There's no agenda. And even after winning the House, what's the first thing that they say? We're going after Hunter Biden. Like, there's no, their whole theme seems to be, you know, going after Biden, going after Hunter Biden. We're going to, Democrats said this is what it is. You know, we're doing this with education. We're taking away women's, like, there's no, as you said, if it's as simple, if what you're saying is true is the Republican agenda used to be as simple as this, then what's being presented to them now, if you're a Republican, is the complete opposite of that. So I think the fact that there is no, this is what we believe in and this is where we're headed and where we're going as a party has made their party go insane. And that's why there's a divide. And with somebody like Donald Trump, who has asserted himself as the leader of the party, said he's back and, you know, is saying the things that he's saying and has said the things that he said is in and is being investigated for the things that he's being investigated as. Nobody's as hopeful in him as the person to lead the party to the next place as they were before. And him running is honestly a gift to the other side because I'm not sure Republicans want him to run. And if they do put up somebody else, Rachel, it splits the vote.
Rachel, me and you could run and beat Trump, like literally.
Let's go.
We could run and beat Trump. You know what I mean? With all of my precarious so browser bad. History, like we could run and beat Trump. Precarious. I'm glad he's back. He's back. He's not the leader of the Republican Party. He's the king of it, and he's gonna be the king for as long as people like Lindsey Graham choke on his dick. Lindsey Graham came out and said Trump sounded presidential, and if he's that guy that he was on the night where he delivered a meandering, barely coherent speech, then he'll be tough to beat. And I already started the party for 2024 because I think I hate Trump more than I like the left. I already started the party for 2024. Here's the deal: Candace Owens is off the Trump train. Or at least she feigned like she was. We'll see what happens. This audio that you're about to hear from Candace Owens is breathtaking. Please play it.
Not only was he just mad, by the way, he then, during a golf session with some mutual friends of ours, had a person next to him who was egging this on, saying to Trump, and I know this because, again, this is a mutual friend, aren't you mad at Candace? Aren't you mad at Candace? Aren't you mad at Candace? And eventually he was like, yeah, I'm so mad at Candace. I'm so mad at Candace. And this got back to me that he was upset with me, that he was angry at me. And the next time that I saw him, he was quite rude to me. He was actually rude to me. I'm telling you this personal story because I think it is something that made me for the first time question him as a person. So you have an individual that spent years defending you, right? And that individual gave you a completely kind and fair interview. You said something yourself that your base didn't like. And you somehow transformed that into something that I did wrong. That's unacceptable.
So Candace, she's a black lady. You always want to help out a black lady. Candace is a black lady. I've talked to Candace before. Like Candace used to.
Y'all are friends.
wouldn't say that we're friends. I mean, I'm not friends with Candace. I'm not friends. I'm saying I was going back and forth. I thought we were going to talk and go back and forth. And back when I thought it was whatever, but I was not friends with Candace Owens. However, still want to help. Because Candace is there saying that Trump was mean to her. And because he was mean to her, she questions what kind of person he is. Jesus Christ. How could this be, Rachel? It's not Trump. So, if Candace had any thoughts on, you know, what kind of person Donald Trump is, we thought we would help her out. We thought we would give her some other instances where Trump has been an asshole. Because obviously she missed all of these things.
Oh.
Rachel, she didn't see him.
Oh, she did?
Okay. No, I'm giving it, no.
I love that you're giving her the benefit of the doubt. That's
benefit!
So kind.
Yeah. That's our 1989. Trump on the Exonerated Five. Of course I hate these people. Donnie, run the sound.
Of course I hate these people. And let's all hate these people because maybe hate is what we need if we're going to get something done.
So 1989. It's 9 years old, Candace. It's Trump. Of course, Donnie, run that sound again. This is Trump on Exonerated Five.
Of course I hate these people. And let's all hate these people because maybe hate is what we need if we're going to get something done.
Wow. Okay. Delightful. We're going to skip forward to Trump and a friend of yours, Rachel, having a conversation, a little locker room talk. If you ever thought that Trump might have been less than a nice guy, Candace, just listen to this.
I got to use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't need to wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You just kiss. You just, you can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy.
Wow. Now, Candace, you might have heard about that. You might have thought that's a one-off. There's no way the decent, nice guy known as Donald Trump. See, I'm not a decent, nice guy, so I know a not decent, nice guy when I see one. Candace, man. I'm not qualified to be the president, but it's not about me. It's about Trump. Once Trump talked about pageant locker rooms, this is what he talked about.
No, I mean, some of these foreign girls, you know, Mr. Trump, in my country, we say hello with vagina.
And, you could also say, as the owner of the pageant, it's your obligation to do that.
So you have done that. Now,
I'll tell you, the funniest is that I'll go backstage before a show.
Yes.
And everyone's getting dressed and ready and everything else. And, you know, no men are anywhere. And I'm allowed to go in because I'm the owner of the pageant, and therefore I'm inspecting it. You know, I'm inspecting. Right. I want to make sure that everything is good.
You're there.
Yeah, the dress is everyone okay? You know, they're standing there with no clothes. Is everybody okay? And you see these incredible looking women. And so I sort of get away with things like that.
He's still going.
Mexicans. All right, I don't want to do this anymore. It's like five.
Let's just get worse and worse. Okay.
And the last thing.
Candace may have forgotten, but we didn't.
And the last thing, Candace, Trump is a scientific genius. I remember during the harrowing times of COVID, we all were searching for answers. We wanted to know what should we do?
Sure.
Wear a mask, not wear a mask.
Yeah.
Can you run outside? Can you get COVID through your computer? Can the virus travel through the internet? All kinds of questions. Will ginger ale solve it? Can black people get it? These are all questions that were litigated. But some of the best ideas came from the stable genius known as Trump. Donnie, play the sound.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning, because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
So a little rundown was just for anyone that just forgot who the man running for president is. And what I'm going to do here, because we're going to play Malcolm Jamal Warner's song at the end of the episode, like we said that yes. we would. But before we do that, we have got to play, and Donnie's going to have to put it in post because we don't have it right now. Have you heard Herschel Walker's Fright Night one? Monologue?
The vampires.
Donnie, have you heard Herschel Walker on Fright Night?
Yes, I'm pulling it up now.
Herschel Walker is the most amazing person that has ever lived.
Wow.
I'm serious.
Because...
I listened to Herschel Walker talk about Fright Night. I've seen the original Fright Night. I've seen the Fright Night remake with Colin Farrell. I don't know what fucking movie Herschel Walker saw.
It is a bad movie.
I don't know what fucking movie Herschel Walker is talking about. There are no werewolves in Fright Night.
In his head movies.
He, Donnie, just run it. Just run this.
I'm going to tell you to keep the faith. Oh, you ever watch a stupid movie late at night hoping it's going to get better? Don't get better, but you keep watching it anyway. Because the other night, I was watching this movie. I was watching this movie called Fright Night, Freak Night, or some type of night. But it was about vampires. I don't know if you know vampires and cool people, are they not? But I'm going to tell you something that I found out. A werewolf can kill a vampire. Did you know that? I never knew that, so I didn't want to be a vampire anymore. I wanted to be a werewolf. But then anyway, as I'm watching this movie, and they can tell how stupid it is because it's 1 a.m. So I'm watching my TV, these kids watching their TV, vampire kill on their TV. So you know it's kind of stupid, but I'm still watching though. As I'm watching this show, what was funny, these kids had a vampire in their attic at their house. So they were watching their TV. Now I'm watching my TV, they watching their TV, or they see the vampire killer on their TV. So they win this contest to bring this actor. Now, y'all got to stay with me. Bring this actor who's a vampire killer from that TV to get rid of this real life vampire in their attic. So as this actor comes to their home, he got all the right stuff. He got all the right stuff because, you know, I got to have a stake and got to have a thing to kill him in the heart. And he got a necklace of garlic because that worked. I don't know what it does, but it worked. You got to have a cross because it burned. I know that worked. And then all of a sudden, this is what was so funny about it. As they're walking through the house, This guy's got the holy water. He's blessing the house, this actor. Now, he's all fake. He's blessing the house with his holy water. They walked upstairs, and this vampire looking real good in this black suit. Whoa, that sounds like Senator Warnock, doesn't it? Looking all good in this black suit, floated from the ceiling. He floated from the ceiling looking good and cool. And I'm thinking, whoa, they better get out of that house. If somebody float from your ceiling, get out of that house. That's not your house. But as he floated from the ceiling, the kid jumped behind their hero. As they jumped behind their hero, the guy jumped in front of him with this holy water, threw it on the vampire forehead. He covered his eyes. And he took his hand away. He started laughing. And he said, that don't work. He took the cross, he put it on the vampire forehead. And the vampire didn't even do anything. He said, that don't work. And that's the way it is in our life. It doesn't even work unless you got faith. It is time for us to have faith. We got to have faith in our fellow brothers.
Message. Hey, stop laughing. Stop. Rachel, stop.
I swear that was Twilight, scary movie, one of the scary movies.
Rachel, stop. Right? Stop. See, you don't have no faith. You know what? Fuck it. Walker for Senate.
Oh my gosh.
We in so much trouble. Something just happened. 75% of the remaining 3,700-ish Twitter employees have opted not to stay.
75%?
There is something happening at Twitter headquarters. Twitter just alerted employees that effective immediately, all office buildings are temporarily closed and badge access is suspended. No details given as to why. We're hearing this because Elon Musk and his team are terrified employees are going to sabotage the company. Also, they're still trying to find out which Twitter workers they need to cut access for. Offices will reopen on November 21st. In the meantime, please continue to comply with the company policy of refraining from discussing confidential company information on social media with the press or anywhere. Something dawned on me about Elon Musk. Something dawned on me about Elon Musk. Okay. So, Elon Musk has made a shit ton of money.
Okay.
How much money is Elon Musk worth? Give me a guess, Rachel.
Like, I don't know, like $100 billion?
200.
Okay.
$200 billion is what Elon Musk is worth. Elon Musk is the richest man in the world. Okay. He's interested in a really peculiar way. He worked with PayPal early on. Okay. PayPal is something that people use. But a lot of stuff that Elon Musk is tremendously wealthy for creating or making has very little effect on the average person, which, as I looked at it, is pretty impressive. Most people that have made that much money have products that in some way affect the average person's life. For example, Bernard Arnault is worth a shit ton of money. Let's look at the richest guys in the world. Richest men in the world. Richest people in the world. The richest people in the world. Not in Florida. Why does Siri do that? I know who the richest person in Florida is. Flo Rida. Richest people in the world. Okay. So, 22 rows. So, richest people in the world. This is real time. It is Elon Musk, Bernard Arnault, Gautam Adani, Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Larry Ellison, and so on. You got Larry Page in there. You got Carlos Slim in there, telecom billionaire down there. When you look at the rest of these people, Bernard Arnault and his family, LVMH. So even if you can't afford like Louis Vuitton, like, my uncle was like, Hennessy's been a part of for a long time. People drink Hennessy. The average person goes out and drinks Hennessy. Drinks spirits, different spirits that LVMH might have, people's spirits. You look at Jeff Bezos, Amazon. Everybody uses Amazon. Amazon is for the common person, right? The common person.
Right.
You look at Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway. He owns a litany of companies. Like Berkshire Hathaway, if you look as a holding company, what they own like fucking Dairy Queen, put like Duracell batteries. So many different companies that you have to have. Like you have, you know, you want a piece of Dairy Queen, go get some Dairy Queen. You want, like, he owns a bunch of the airlines, people have to fly, blah, blah, blah. Bill Gates, Microsoft. Obviously, for a long time, everybody had to have Microsoft. Carlos Slim, telecom. Larry Page, Google. Elon Musk is different in that Tesla is a luxury brand and you have to be sort of rich to have a Tesla. SpaceX, space exploration, all of that stuff, really awesome, right? But that is not really affecting the average person, right?
Right.
Any of the stuff that he's doing, talking about trying to create the Hyperloop, all of this stuff is theoretical. Like, Elon Musk is one of the most interesting hyper-rich people ever because it's not like he owns Walmart. It's not like he owns, like, Amazon or like, Dell Computers, I'm looking at. Like, all of these people, media magnates, Nike, you got Phil Knight here, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, all of this stuff that people own, the Mars family. He really is kind of like he's a theoretical billionaire. Like, they're obviously really, there are real reasons why the stock of these companies are valued at so much. There's real reasons why he's so wealthy. I'm not saying that they're not. I'm just saying that Elon Musk is out of his depth as it relates to Twitter because he doesn't know how the average person thinks and moves.
Interesting.
Like, he doesn't, the person that can, like, so having a conversation with some friends of mine, they're like, well, eventually people are going to have to buy Twitter. You're going to have to get on Twitter. I'm like, yo, man, I know a lot of motherfuckers who will not pay for Twitter. They're not going to pay for it. I know a lot of people who still ask me for $25, $50 from back home. They're not going to buy Twitter.
Right.
And to be honest with you, it's like they're just communicating. Like, he's so out of his depth and trying to be a regular non or make a service for people that people use all the time, that like somebody who's not trying to fucking go to space or have their car drive to their mama house for them, which, you know, all of that stuff. He's just out of his depth. He doesn't know what average people really want, what regular people who communicate on Twitter really want. And he's never had to know that to make $200 billion.
Which is why I think he's had trouble internally with his companies, because it seems like he also doesn't know how to talk to the average person. You know, set Twitter for the side, there's also all these issues that are going on within Tesla. It's like he's out of touch with the everyday person, which is why he can send out an email like he did for Twitter, which is what we're talking about making people click a link, yes or no, within 48 hours. I think it was 48 hours, correct me if I'm wrong, of are you willing to stay with the company and move forward or not? And as you just reported, 75% of the people were like, nah, there's a disconnect there. And it seems like it's starting to catch up with him. It's interesting.
It's nuts. It's nuts. All right, we're out. No mailbag. We gave you guys a fucking 2-hour podcast.
Jam pack. We made up for missing on Monday. Jam pack Tuesday.
We're gonna know what happens to Twitter. There might not be a Twitter on Monday. We'll probably be all better off if there's.
Are you gonna be okay?
You're
an avid Twitter user.
I've gone way down on the tweeting.
Okay.
I'm not like my mental health is too important. You guys, I love you all.
Good for you.
Rachel, how are you feeling?
Better.
I know you are.
Better.
Yeah. Rachel, I'll let you take us out in your own Rachel sick voice. Take us out.
In my own Rachel sick voice. Guys, we're so happy to be back. Sorry we missed earlier this week, but we brought you something great this episode. Take a thinking caps off, but don't stop thinking. I am Rachel and Lindsay.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Supposed to be me. My voice sounds so much sexier than that right now. So much sexier than that.
Bye.